Ni hao, Patrick here with a podcast dominated by, well, what you learn when you learn Chinese, whether it's at school in San Francisco or in the beauty shops of Beijing. How did you fare in math and science at school? Would you have done better or worse if you'd been taught those subjects in a second language? We'll check in on a new PBS documentary on the subject. Also, in China, if you don't have a Chinese name, it's a good idea to get one. Deborah Fallows reluctantly agreed to be called Jebi. Sounds a bit like Debbie.
What it means in Chinese is to borrow a pen. I just felt ridiculous. You know, what's your name? Wo jiao Jebi. My name is to borrow a pen. You know, I couldn't finally use it. I cast it aside. I never got name cards. I just failed in that part of the mission.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words. Rah. New words, old words, censoring everything.
The World in Words podcast, just like the World Radio Program, otherwise known as The Big Show. Wait a minute, does that make the podcast The Little Show? Anyway, they're both co-produced right here in Boston by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH. The website for The Big Show is theworld.org. The website for this pod is theworld.org/language. That's where you can find the notes that I write up after I do a podcast. I also publish them at patrickcox.wordpress.com. Other places you can find me are the World in Words Facebook group and on Twitter. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. This week, a film about four kids and the very different reasons why their parents decided to send them to public schools, American public schools, where they take their classes in two languages. Then a conversation with writer Deborah Fallows about learning Chinese. This for her was essentially a way of learning about the Chinese people. She lived there for 3 years. She came back with a bunch of great stories and insights. Okay, so first, a story about a documentary on PBS. For non-Americans, PBS is the public broadcasting service here in the United States. The film is called Speaking in Tongues, and it depicts four kids in San Francisco, each of them growing up bilingual. Now, what you're about to hear is the final part of a four-part series that we ran on The Big Show about American school kids learning all kinds of subjects in foreign languages. Now, I reported this particular installment, and I was drawn to the story because, well, as you'll hear, there's a family backstory. Here goes. There are many reasons to learn a foreign language. There are the ones that parents think about, and then there are the others.
Most Chinese people, if you walk into a store, they don't usually see a Caucasian boy speaking Chinese fluently, so I get a lot of free stuff, so that's pretty fun.
Jaden Jamel Schneider and his brother go to dual immersion public schools in San Francisco. They take some classes in Chinese, others in English. Their parents don't speak Chinese.
Also, me and my brother, if we have secrets and my parents are around, that's another great use of a different language.
So many good reasons to speak a foreign language. When Jaden's parents sent their elder son to Chinese immersion school, friends and family were perplexed. 4 years later, when they did the same with Jaden, people around them nodded in approval.
And we looked at each other and thought, well, what's going on here? We haven't changed. The school hasn't changed. But what had changed was the world.
This is Ken Schneider. He and Jaden's mom, Marsha Jarmel, happened to be filmmakers. So they made a movie, not about their kids, but about four other students in San Francisco public schools who are also doing much of their learning in a second language. Their reasons for learning are different, and each touches on a big theme. There's the son of Mexican immigrants who never went to school themselves, but now want their boy to learn in English and Spanish. There's the son of white middle-class parents who want their boy exposed to Chinese culture. There's a black kid who lives with his mother in public housing. She says learning Chinese will be a way out and a way in. And there's Kelly Wong.
Kelly Wong is a second-generation Chinese-American whose parents lost the language that her grandparents speak, and they lost it to assimilation and probably some degree of shame for having been different. Her grandparents, their English is modest at best. So for her and her family, the issue is very urgent, that if they don't bring the language back into the household, they will be severing not only language, but also the cultural lineage in that family.
小朋友，我们几个邻居。
The movie unabashedly champions the idea of raising kids bilingually, but it also shows how hard it is in the face of what appears to be the prevailing public view that it's not a good thing. Most states in the U.S. have some form or other of an official English law on their books. The film seeks to put arguments against bilingual learning to rest by citing recent research, research that suggests that the bilingual brain has an edge over the single language brain. Yet some of the most poignant moments in the movie come when doubt sets in. Here, a parent at a Spanish immersion school pleads with teachers for more English and less Spanish. A different parent at the same school raises another concern.
In the cafeteria, there was great art on the wall. Everyone from Latin America. Do they learn about American heroes? I didn't see Martin Luther King, for example, on the cafeteria wall. Are the teachers aware that they're in the U.S.?
But the fundamental debate takes place at a family banquet in a Chinese restaurant. It's between two white Americans who are related by marriage to Kelly Wong. The first person to speak is Kelly's great aunt. She doesn't think Kelly should be attending a Chinese immersion school.
This country, so much is offered to the children to speak other languages. We don't have to teach it in school. We really don't. It's taken away from their other curriculum. And in America, we should speak English. This is America. I don't think I should be paying my taxes for someone else to learn a language. My son's giving me the evil eye.
Yeah, you've got a global economy. You're able to travel to different countries. You've got to be able to communicate with someone in their language. Not everyone's going to be how we were, starting here, staying here, not having much contact outside of what we had. They've got to have more tools.
The film, of course, sides with that argument. Filmmaker Ken Schneider says he sympathizes with Kelly's great aunt and many millions of people with similar views, but he says they're wrong.
I think these folks don't have all the information. And the challenge, again, is for Kelly and her family to withstand the slings and arrows of the well-meaning family members and to still exceed the expectations of their family and their teachers.
As for Kelly, she's come up with yet another reason for learning a second language. On the basketball court, she and her schoolmates call their plays in Chinese. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox. To see images from Speaking in Tongues and to find out when your PBS station may be playing it, go to theworld.org/language. Before we leave the story, I just want to play a couple of outtakes from my conversation with Ken Schneider and his wife, Marsha Jarmel. I was intrigued about their choice of language for their kids to study. Aside from Chinese, the obvious language to pick was Spanish. Remember, this is California, which has more Spanish speakers than a lot of countries do, where Spanish is the official first language. So here's my exchange with Marsha.
Most people, I think, who want to raise their kids to speak two or more languages will pick languages which have some family resonance. I mean, there is some heritage aspect, even if they don't themselves speak it. But that's not the case here.
Well, we might have chosen, there are Spanish immersion schools, and we might have chosen that if it was closer to our house. But it turned out the value for us was learning a second language, and the school that was closest to our house, where our kids had a chance to get in, because it's a lottery here, was Chinese at that time. And we thought we had less of a chance to get into the Spanish immersion school. So it wasn't a strategic decision. It was more of a logistical decision 9 years ago or 10 years ago when we were applying to schools. Now it might look different.
Meaning what?
Well, just that, in the years when we were starting, when we were making this decision, Chinese was just not really China wasn't so much on the horizon. And now you see that knowing Chinese is a very useful language. Then it just seemed like a practical family decision because it was easier to get to the school. And the one other thing I'd say is that, you know, we live in a community in our particular neighborhood where there are many opportunities to practice your Chinese. So in some ways, Spanish is less useful for our kids as kids growing up here. You know, we go to the local shopping street and all the shop owners know they speak Cantonese or Mandarin and they won't speak to them in English. So they, you know, there's a kind of cultural neighborhood piece to choosing Chinese over Spanish also.
So it worked out pretty well, even though the choice was somewhat arbitrary. That said, when I asked Ken about this, he speaks Spanish, by the way, he sounded a little more wistful.
I was hoping that we would make Spanish work, actually, because I had fantasies of taking the family to Uruguay or Barcelona for a year abroad at some point. And I was a little disappointed when it didn't, but I have to say that I was very drawn to the academic rigor of the Chinese immersion school, which is both a blessing and a challenge. And not to say that other languages don't also have that, but the Chinese system of teaching and learning is a very rigorous and to some people a very rigid one due to the way you have to learn characters and that you have to learn them in stroke order. And there was something about that that actually attracted me because I knew that our kids would be in good hands, that the teachers had a missionary zeal about them. They really felt the gravity of their work. And I was drawn to having them be in an environment where, I don't know how to put this, in an environment where learning and respect were paramount.
Wow. Forget any preconceived notions you may have about San Francisco being a city of touchy-feely, can-we-all-get-along people. No, it's full of Dickensian parents, hot for Victorian throwback values like discipline, rigor, and respect. Well, I know, that's not any more true than the touchy-feely characterization. And let me say right here that San Francisco is far and away, my favorite American city. But I should say that I have heard other parents say similar things about Chinese, that beyond the language, or maybe through the language, through learning the language, there's a teaching method that speaks to a way of raising kids. I don't know what you call it, a new Confucianism or something like that. Well, we're going to stay with Chinese now. Boy, are we going to stay with it. And hear from Deborah Fallows. She recently returned from 3 years of living in China, in Beijing and Shanghai. She has a PhD in linguistics. So when it came to writing a book about her time there, she chose to write about the language. But if you're expecting an academic tome, you're going to be disappointed. This book is for the general reader. It's great fun to read. It was especially fun for me as a Chinese learner. But I imagine that pretty much anyone with an interest in language, or in China for that matter, is going to get an awful lot out of this book. It's called Dreaming in Chinese. Now, if you're a regular listener to NPR's All Things Considered, this may be ringing a bell. Deborah did an interview with that show a couple of weeks ago. I'll post a link to that at all the usual places. But anyway, when Deborah and I talked, we didn't go over the same ground, with one exception, and that is Chinese etiquette. We have more time here on the pod than a drive time radio show does. And we took the discussion a little bit further to a really interesting place, I think. And apropos of that, listen out for the expression "buyao," which will serve as this week's Eating Sideways. I almost sounded angry when I said that, huh? Buyao. Literally, it means don't want or don't need. But in Chinese, it covers a whole lot more. Well, just one more thing before I start this interview. I figure that some of you listening will know all about tones and tonal languages like Chinese. And some people will know nothing. And then there are people like me, maybe like a lot of you, who know a little bit, but not an awful lot. So first off, I asked Deborah to give me her take on tones, how in Chinese they rule, and how in English they may not rule, but they still kind of exist.
Here's what's going on in English. We actually have some tones, and maybe this is a good way to start explaining it. If you say something in English like, take your hat, and you hear the tone rising on the word hat, it doesn't change the meaning of the word, but it changes the whole meaning of the sentence.
Right.
So a rising tone there means that you're asking a question, as opposed to take your hat, which is just a statement or maybe a command. In Chinese, those tones don't change the meaning of the whole sentence like they do in English, but they actually change the meaning of the word.
Right.
So you have a rising tone, like sure, or a falling tone, sure, or a high tone, sure, or a falling, rising tone, sure. And it's an integral part of each of those words that a tone goes with a meaning. So as hard as it is for us to understand, to hear those tones, to remember those tones, to use those tones to connect with the right meaning, it's even harder for the Chinese to disentangle a tone from a word. It's just not possible. It's part of the meaning of the word as much as the sound is the meaning of the word.
And you make this observation that the Chinese don't really hear them as tones. I mean, as you say, it's part of the whole package. So you get really stuck if you're using the wrong tone.
You get really stuck. And of course, there are sophisticated, linguistically worldly people in China who've had a lot of experience with foreigners and foreign languages, and they know that this is a problem. So they can work pretty hard and are with you and are more familiar with foreigners having this problem with tones. But generally, you know, there's 1.3 billion people in China. So the ones who can work with you are pretty few and far between. And it's much more likely when you're on the street or when you really need it, you know, dealing with a merchant, dealing with a taxi driver, dealing with anybody out in the countryside, dealing with the laobaixing, which are the average people, that you will just draw a complete blank from them when you're using the wrong tone. And I think the hard thing is that it's just impossible for most Chinese to make the leap of imagination to think that the foreigner is actually saying something else. You have to kind of click through so many, like a computer, through so many possibilities of what that word should be, that you just can't get there. And of course, by the time you're there, you're farther down along in the sentence and you've completely bungled it and it doesn't make any sense. And so it's all gone.
Wow. I can't wait to go to China to practice my very bad Chinese.
I think everyone has a tone story there. And it's frustrating because it's frustrating for you as a new learner. And it's frustrating for the Chinese because they just kind of throw up their hands and think, what's going on here? I can't get there from here.
Right, right. Another thing that people initially may be put off by, but ultimately you're warm to, is this notion of etiquette. Chinese etiquette is extremely different. In fact, almost the reverse of etiquette here in the United States. As you put it, you know, rude is polite. We say please and thank you a lot, and there's a lot of formality in the language that we don't even notice. Whereas in China, you're only formal when you have to be. And rudeness is a form of intimacy, almost.
It's a really interesting situation. And I first was thinking about this when I thought, well, when I'm speaking Chinese, I feel so abrupt. I feel so short, and I feel even rude a lot of times. So imagine this. You're in a restaurant, and you're sitting at a table next to a family of eating next to you at another table, or maybe close friends, and you're watching their very polite choreography of how this meal is unfolding. There's a common pot of chicken bits in the middle, and the mom uses her chopsticks, picks out the finest morsels for the little child, puts them on the plate. The dad will be pouring for everyone tea before he pours for himself, and so forth, and everything looks fine. And then all of a sudden, someone will blurt out, "Gei wo yan," which means, "Give me the salt." It doesn't mean, "Please pass the salt," or "May I have the salt?" And every Westerner's instinct, you know, as a mom, I want to kind of leap up and say please to the little kid. So there's this disconnect between what you see in what seems like polite behavior and then what you hear, no please, no thank you, no softening to the language. I was reading in some of my grammar books and came across this explanation from a Chinese linguist, which said that inserting these pleases and thank yous into an exchange like this actually is putting a distance between you and the person you're with. And if you're with someone who's very close to you, saying a please or saying a thank you in a situation like that is actually seen as offensive and a bit rude, just rather than as being polite. And I talked to some of my tutors about it, and this one great young guy named Danny said, "Of course, you know, we think that Westerners are so gratuitous in always saying please and thank you for everything. But if you're with your good friend, why would you say please or thank you? It's like saying please or thank you to yourself. It makes no sense at all." So that's the explanation, which takes some time to absorb and get used to, which you actually do. And then, you know, you kind of have to watch yourself. Or when you come home, it's like one of those words that doesn't translate. If you say voila in French or whatever the case may be, bouillot is something that you can bring home with you easily and actually find a lot of instances. Don't want, don't need, you know, leave me alone. It's just kind of a shortcut that is fun to use.
I found a similar thing in my Chinese class. The better your Chinese teacher gets to know you, the more likely she is to insult you, call you a liar, call you overweight, bring up all of these, you know, things that people don't, that people just don't bring up in a typical American classroom setting. I've come to find it quite funny, although some of my classmates, especially the newer ones, they find this straight talk quite harsh.
Yeah, it's off-putting. And actually, the word peng, which means fat in Chinese, right, is a really interesting case because, you know, I was watching teenage girls talking to each other. They might say, jin tian peng, like, today you're looking fat. And the other would just kind of go, oh, shrug her shoulders. Yeah. Whereas if anyone in the Western world said that to your friend, you know, you might get a slap or a punch or a hurt look at the very least. This directness in certain things, peng, how much do you earn? What's your rent?
Right.
You know, what's your salary? That those kinds of personal comments are much more just give me the facts or say the facts. Obviously, it causes a lot of miscommunications. Although I must say, as a cultural data point, peng, being fat, is something that's probably changing a little bit in China.
Right.
I noticed even during the time I was there that you saw, thanks to McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and so forth, a lot more chubby youth walking around than you used to see. And you get the first inklings of the young women starting to worry about this, but it's not the same and it's not there yet. So, you know.
Is this harsh talk, is this a case of the language reflecting the people or is it something else?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, which comes first? Certainly you see a lot of indications or reasons to believe there's a lot of rudeness and abruptness in China. I mean, you're always leaping out of the way of somebody spitting on you, although that's not necessarily seen as rude.
Right.
People shoving you, people kind of getting in the way. It is, in many respects, a pretty harsh life in China, and you kind of have to keep your elbows out and marching full speed ahead to make some space for yourself or get where you want to be. So there is, you know, the public behavior and the body language that goes on is something that we would see as rude and we would see as connecting with the Chinese expressions of being rude. Interestingly, one thing that was really notable to me was during the time of the Sichuan earthquake, this was in the spring of 2008, we had been in China for 2 years by that point. So, you know, I had a pretty thick skin. I could kind of bustle my way down the street with the best of them, and I could say my booyahs, and I had some intuition of what was going on there. And then the earthquake happened, and suddenly it just felt like the whole country became softer, both in the language that I heard and in what I was seeing. When that happened, I turned on my TV, and like everyone else, I was glued to the television footage for about the next week. And I grabbed my grammar books, and I started writing down all the words that were new to me that I wasn't understanding from the broadcast. Gone were the really heavily produced TV segments, and suddenly in their place was the street language. People talking on the street to each other, very unrehearsed, very spontaneous. And you saw both a different level of behavior toward each other. Everyone went rushing to help everyone else. Everyone was comforting everyone else. So whereas before, if you saw a traffic accident on the street, people would scatter. No one wanted to help the victim. No one wanted accountability. But after the earthquake, everyone went rushing to the scene of the devastation, trying to help everyone else. And the language that I heard were much, much more softer words. Since I heard them repeating again and again, I had time to go look it up in my dictionaries, and they were words like depend on or comfort or an interesting word called bei, which is not only to carry, but it's specifically to carry someone on your back, like we would say in the U.S., piggyback.
Mm.
In Sichuan, you see people carrying each other on their backs up and down the mountains because that's the mode of transport without good roads and so forth. And you saw soldiers carrying old people carrying younger people, children carrying tinier children. And you heard this word bei all the time. And then you heard all the xie xies, all the thank yous came out. You would hear people just with a string of thank you, xie xie, gan xie, gan xie, gan xie, xie xie xie. Just the general tone of the language seemed much softer in to match the body language in that particular moment in China, which was in stark contrast to the everyday life before right. and to the everyday life that it, of course, kind of faded away into after many months.
Wow, what an amazing time to have been there. See that change
yes.
in the language.
Change in language, change in posture, change in reaction. And of course, you know, things like that are generally not permanent. The similar situation here was certainly in September 2001.
Right.
When people became nice for a while and they drove more nicely, they treated each other more nicely. And I would say it has probably reverted to what it was yep. on September 10th, 2001.
Now, one of the things that you had to do when you first arrived in China was to get a Chinese name. Everyone needs to have a Chinese name,
oh.
right? So how did you and your family go about getting those names?
Oh, this was so hard. When we got to China, people said, you need two things if people are going to take you seriously. You need a mobile phone, because that's the mode of communication. Like, your phone number is you. It's like tones. You and your phone number are one. The tone in that syllable is one, and it means one thing. And you need a Chinese name. This was a problem. My husband, who shares the same last name, Fallows, had a lot of friends working on this problem for him. And he came up with the family name Feng, because it sounds kind of like Fallows. I mean, nothing sounds like Fallows, but at least you have the same F sound at the beginning. And interestingly, in China, there are like 85% of the people share the same 100 family names. So we chose Feng because it's a common name and it was easy for people to understand. Then they try to match up your first name with something that seems kind of like you.
Hmm.
And my husband is a small plane pilot. You know, I think he thinks of himself as a flyboy or something. It's very dashing to have that as part of his identity. So they came up with a name that is Feng Fei Jie, which means the Fei
right?
is like to fly or plane, and the Jie means something like very handsome and dashing. So it's like the whole thing kind of comes up to be flyboy.
I want
so
that name.
Yeah, he has a great name, and whenever he uses his Chinese name, Feng Feiji, people just kind of cluck cluck and say, oh, great name, you know, great name. I had a much bigger problem myself, because my name, Deborah, Deb, Debbie, any version of that just didn't work very well in Chinese, and the closest they could come up with was, there isn't really a de sound, but the jie is kind of like de. It sounds pretty much the same in this Chinese phonetic system. So they came up with Debbie, which sounds kind of like Debbie, but what it means in Chinese is to borrow a pen. So I just felt ridiculous. You know, what's your name? Wo jiao Debbie, my name is to borrow a pen. And I just, you know, I couldn't finally use it. I cast it aside. I never got name cards. I just failed in that part of the mission.
You stuck with your American name.
Yeah, I did.
It strikes me as odd. I mean, like over here, people have names that are clearly indicate that they're from another place. They're from a foreign culture. Their native tongue is different. Whereas in China, if you're going to adopt a family name that is one of the, you know, 100 popular names and also other words that, you know, are Chinese words, that's not going to indicate anything about your background or where you're from, right?
No, and it's a funny problem. Like, if you're reading a newspaper story about some guy who is a petty thief, he's always identified as so-and-so, surname Wang, had this encounter on the street. I think surname Wang, that could be just about anyone in the entire country. It's a very complicated set of things going on. You've got the family name, which means, you know, very little in that sense. You're one of them. You've got often traditionally a middle name which identifies the generation in your family, like you and all your brothers and sisters, at least back in the day when you had brothers and sisters and cousins, would have the same generational name as your middle name. And then the first name would be this elaborate dance of choosing something that sounded good with the first two names and that meant something auspicious and maybe resonated in meaning with the whole package. There are many, many things that go together with this. But then a lot of people just end up being called big sister or little sister or Gugu, big brother or little brother in the family, or number two. And it's very common among Chinese to choose an English name to go by. If you have any connection at all with the English-speaking world or the foreign world in China, if you're in a service industry or if you're a teacher or if you work in the markets where foreigners go, somebody will give you a foreign name because I think they like it, and they also realize that it makes it a lot easier on everybody to have this recognizable, identified foreign name.
You got to name one of the assistants in your local beauty shop.
Oh, well, one of the great girly things to do in China is cheap manicures and pedicures. So I would go for my mani all the time, you know, $3 or $4, and get to know the girls in my little shop. They usually were young women, maybe between 18 and 22, who had come in from small villages in the countryside to make their way in the big city, and of course, always over the objection of their parents. So there was a kind of constant rotation of these young girls from a certain village in Shaanxi, which is west of Beijing, in the little place where I worked. And one day, this new girl came in, and I was watching her for many months, kind of trying to learn her trade. And then one day, they assigned her to me as her first kind of test case of a mani-pedi. So she did my mani, which took about an hour. And as I was talking to her, her name was Xiao Shui, I asked her, well, do you have an English name? And she gave me this, shot me this look like, what a silly question. Of course I don't have an English name. You know, I'm from the countryside in China. I couldn't possibly have an English name. This was a Chinese conversation, but I could tell very much what she was thinking. So I asked her if she would like an English name, and her face just lit up. And so I tried to pull out a number of English names that I thought might work with her name, Xiao Shui. So I came up with Sharon, Sandy, Sasha. And as soon as I said Sasha, she just stopped in her tracks and said, Sasha, that's it. You know, she wanted to be called Sasha. So it was a great moment where I felt like I'd connected with this young girl. But then I had this huge responsibility that I had suddenly named this girl for the rest of her life.
Right.
And she was going to go on with the very lovely name of Sasha. I saw her later. She was still using it.
Deborah Fallows, who is most definitely not still using the name Jiabi. Her book is called Dreaming in Chinese. It's out in both the US and the UK. Different subtitles in each of those countries, though. I'm not sure if subtitle is quite the right word. I think I just made it up. I mean, the sentence that explains what the book is supposedly about that comes just right after the main title. You know, it's de rigueur for most nonfiction books these days. So the full title of the US book is Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. And the UK version is Dreaming in Chinese and Discovering What Makes a Billion People Tick. You decide which one you like better. If you like this discussion, there are plenty of other goodies in previous pods on the Chinese language, namely podcasts 14 and 15, which were entirely devoted to various aspects of the language. I should have made podcast 88 a Chinese one, because 8's a lucky number for the Chinese. Let's see, what was in 88? Let me look it up here. Yeah, the guy who was learning 37 languages. That Kurdish film and that crazy Ukrainian performance artist. Nothing Chinese there, but it was a pretty good one. Anyway, that's it for this week. Not sure what's coming up next week, but I hope you'll be back to check it out. See you then, or sooner, on Facebook or Twitter. Bye.
你为什么还不说话